So anyway, they all say, yes, we understand, we're working on it. We'll try to get something done as quickly as possible, whatever that means. So that's, and that was just there last week.
But I think to Derek's point, and that's a lot of the pre-work that we've done with this process is we've removed the design standards and made it a living document so that we could modify that as this progresses further, because we know there'll be progression and changes. And that's something we specifically put in place to be able to manage ourselves.
Well,
modifying that.
I guess part of what I'm saying is when you come to council for Fogel, address the co-location and the underground.
I was speaking with him just this morning.
You're expecting to see that.
I was speaking with him just this morning.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
Alan? Pardon me. Alan Kirchmark, Finance Department, Chairman Herlihy. I'd like to point out that we have right-of-way regulations for other utilities as well. And we recently did some work with the franchise for public service company, Excel. And I just like to make sure that we make sure the definitions and criteria are the same. So I'm going to reach out to Derek and try to make sure that ever takes place.
Consistency is a good thing.
Well, every now and then.
All right. Any other questions, discussion?
Go back to one, Steve. When you mentioned power, can't be run underground to power these?
No, what I'm saying is, so some of these are like a refrigerator and a pole. And so there's an electronics portion, and I don't know the exact terminology, but there is a portion of that that doesn't have to hang on the pole. It could be located underground. So the idea is to minimize the profile on the pole by putting everything that's possible underground.
I make a motion we approve and recommend that City Council adopt the Wireless Communication Code in Title 14 of the Loveland Municipal Code and associated revisions in the Unified Development Code in Title 18 and pole attachment provisions in Title 13 of the Loveland Municipal Code.
I have a second, then I have a comment. Based on what Alan said and the fact that every time you read through something like this, you find modifications probably as you go forward that be subject to whatever changes staff has in the meantime before they get it to the council. Is that acceptable?
Yes.
That'd be great.
So that's an amendment?
They meant to end a second.
All right.
Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Point of order. We just made an amendment
to his motion.
Okay. Then we're voting on the amendment first. We can't vote on it combined.
Right.
You can't vote on the amendment, and then you have to vote on the motion, right?
Correct.
According to Robert's rule.
Okay. So your amendment again, Randy, was to include language to allow for revisions?
Yeah. The recommendation to the City Council to adopt this subject to the modifications that might occur as staff goes through by the time they get there.
So let's go ahead and have a vote on Randy's amendment.
Second.
Okay.
You got a second amendment, Mark?
All those in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, then to the main motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Hey. So we're going to move on to what is item 6 on the agenda next, which is supplemental budget appropriations for the Boise Avenue land acquisition. Roger.
Oh, I thought he was standing.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I was under the... No, I'd be more than happy to. I was under the impression you were...
I'm enjoying this, I really, I just...
This should be very quick.
Yeah.
We'll go with plans.
I'll get a chance to listen.
Should be very quick.
Okay, this is a request to amend the budget to include an additional $875,000 to purchase some property. The property is located just north of the wastewater treatment plant here, if you could go to the next one.
You have a clicker.
Oh, clicker, I don't know how to use it. There's 9.1 acres just north of the wastewater plant, there you can see our site here. And the two big circles there are the new anaerobic digesters that were just built in the last 2 years. So the backstory is the property has been for sale for a couple of years. And last fall, it was put under contract by a developer. And the developer had proposed 90 cottage homes on that parcel. And so the proposal was brought to our city's development review team about three times over the last 8 or 9 months. And there were lots and lots of comments and concerns from transportation and parks, and every department had some concern or another. And our main concern was the potential for odor complaints. You can see that there are some homes around, you know, within 500-600 feet of the plant already. And historically, there's been some complaints from those people, but I think they've gotten used to the fact that the plant's there to stay. So those calls have backed off quite a bit in recent years. But when those homes were built, we got quite a few complaints. So you can imagine parking a house right here. It would be tremendous. So the developer that had the contract on the property backed out. He let the contract go. And so we saw the opportunity to go in and make an offer on the property. So we've done that. And we have a contract at this point for a full price of, the price is actually $850,000, but we've asked for another $25,000 to cover any closing costs, environmental assessment, and who knows what could come about that we may need some money for. So,
did you have to bring water rights to it? Has that been concluded?
No, there is already an existing tap. I'm not proposing anything yet except for
Roger,
yeah.
Can I ask a question? Is
sure.
there an appraisal that backs up that price?
Where's Derek?
Or informs that price?
I don't know.
I don't know either. What we do know is the prior contract on the property was for a full price offer. And so we felt like the landowner is going to expect a full price offer, and we thought it was worth it just to get this deal done to prevent that potential for lawsuits and odor complaints in the future. So the purpose of this is to get a supplemental appropriation to go ahead and move forward with this purchase. So if that all goes through, then our plan would be to file some easements, restrictive covenants, something on that property to prevent residential development. So right now, that's kind of the general plan. We think it could be suitable for a nursery, a landscape company, storage units, maybe one estate lot. You know, maybe a person with some horses or something like that could take advantage of this.
Cell tower.
If possible.
Solar.
Charge high
solar
rent.
Farm.
Solar farm, that would be fine. Anything except residential, basically. You know, some light industrial uses or just open space. That's the goal here. That's what we're trying to do. Trying to think of anything else I can share.
Do you
have
another photograph?
Oh, yes, we have one more picture. This is standing right on Boise Avenue looking south. So you can see those giant concrete structures. That's the new anaerobic digesters that were just built and have just gotten into service as of this past week. So it's fun. One more slide here will summarize what we're trying to do here. Supplemental appropriation. We'll be doing a phase one environmental assessment here in the next couple weeks. We plan to close in September. We are going to give the property owner some additional time to get rid of all of the vehicles and buildings on the site. So when we take possession of it, there would be nothing left on the site. It would be vacant. There is a water tap and a water sewer or a sewer service to the property. So it would be pretty a good spot for one nice estate lot with some horse property type of thing. So that's a possibility. Again, we would record some restrictive covenants on this over time, potentially, and then repurposing the property to sell it in the future to mitigate this potential for lawsuits and odor complaints.
I think it's an excellent move.
OK.
Okay.
I tell you, the reason, I'll plead guilty on this one. In Southern California, at my utility there, we had a wastewater treatment plant that had been there for decades. And there was a vacant lot adjacent to it that was used for green waste, that just dumping and things. And one day we drove by and they were cleaning it up. I thought, well, that's darn nice of the county to clean that up. That's nice. Next time we drove by, they were grading, and the next time they started plotting out streets. They would put in some very, very high-end homes right next to the plant. I could actually throw from the headworks, which is probably the least pleasant portion of the plant, I could throw a baseball into the closest home's upstairs window. That's how close they built them. And then they turned around and blamed us for not being able to sell. They sued us. They turned us into the South Coast Air Quality Management District for odor complaints. And when I left my employment there, they were still in the middle of litigation. And it had dragged on for about 2 years at that time. And I was aware that for some years after that, that was still ongoing. So this is a defensive move is what this is.
And this site is forever. This will always be a wastewater plant as long as the right. City of Loveland exists, as far as I could tell.
Steve? Basically, we're getting into the development business.
Not really. We want to sell it to somebody who would develop it.
Okay, whatever that category is, we're in land management or whatever. Have we done this before?
Yes. We buy property.
We buy property and turn around and...
Well, you know what we're doing in the downtown.
Well, what we're trying to do.
Downtown.
we bought property at I-25 and Highway 402. And we hope to sell it at some point for some...
What's it?
Profit.
402.
92 acres.
Oh, Ehrlich.
And again, Councilor, the primary reason, like I said, this is a defensive purchase. Yeah. This is.
Well, I understand.
I mean, I'm not into this for speculative reasons. No. I'm doing this as purely a defensive action against residential development there.
And you know, there's a pretty good likelihood that when we resell this, we'll be getting less than $850. I would guess. I don't know that for a fact, but it depends on who comes along and wants to buy it and makes us an offer.
We're going to take a haircut.
A little bit, yeah. And it's probably worth it.
The court.
Yeah. There are, right now, the way it sits today, there was no way that we could stop them from putting those homes on there. You know, we could require some buffers and stuff like that, but we couldn't completely stop them from building 400 feet from the wastewater plant. And it's just going to be a huge problem forever. And those people just don't understand that smell is forever.
Does Larry want to talk to us about the Chubbuck water?
That was kind of an extra bonus there, Randy. Yeah, that's all that was.
Bonus it is. There's a little there, but we're constrained from using it for municipal purposes, except on site.
They can use it on the site to irrigate their garden and the pasture there, the hay field. They show us where the headgate comes in at. I don't know if it works or not, but it's there.
I see the realtor suggested one of the possible uses was a feed yard or livestock facility.
That'd be great.
The prior inhabitants, this facility was located in Chino, the Chino Basin. Every single one of our neighbors was a dairy farm, and we thought they were the absolute finest neighbors to have. And then as development occurred, the dairy farms went away, and the houses came in, and this was the last parcel. And it hadn't been dairy farm, but as I was leaving, the last dairy farm adjacent to us was going away. So they're a great neighbor. They really are.
This is Gene.
We did something similar down in the city of Longmont. Does the owner know that the city is purchasing this?
Yes.
Okay. We tried to keep it confidential. It was a buyer down in Longmont to keep the price reasonable.
Okay. John has a question.
I make a motion to approve and recommend City Council adopt a supplemental budget and appropriation in the amount of $875,000 to purchase the property at 460 South Boise Avenue.
Second.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Roger.
Yep.
Okay, now we will move to what is item four on the agenda, power cost of service rate study preliminary results.
I'm sorry.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here again. Of course, this is kind of a, spoke to you back in April, kind of talked to you about what we're going to do in this study. And one of the things that we did is a financial projection, and a five-year financial projection. Our models actually go out 40 years, but we kind of just show you five of it. And in that model, we project out revenues, expenses, and of course, power supply costs. And the power supply cost structures change. And I'm just going to talk about that briefly, because it does impact the cost of service study, and you see some modifications. Overall, though, the study actually looks pretty good. As part of the financial projection, we also look at key financial targets to talk about. One is debt coverage ratio. You're a financially stable utility, you don't owe any debt. We look at what the minimum level of cash reserves the utility should maintain. And as an upper boundary, we define what's called a target operating income. And I'll talk about that when I come to that slide. Then we'll look at the cost of service results. This shows how much it costs to provide service to each class of customers and compares it to how much revenue we are anticipating to receive from that class. So get this class to fully meet its cost of service requirements would need this amount of an increase. You're going to see, you know, over the years, those have come closer and closer together. And what we're looking for from the commission is basically input on the rate track that we put together. If you agree with the rate track on the rate adjustments, so what we want to do is go back and design the rates, all right? And the other thing is when we look at the cost of service results, how much leeway around that average rate adjustment will you allow me to move some of the classes a little bit closer to cost of service? And you're going to see most of your major classes are pretty close, but there's some classes where we've always been dealing with that are dramatically underpaying, and it's done intentionally, and when we come to that, I'll explain it. Now, one of the things I want to emphasize is, you know, I can sit here and talk about cost of service, all right, cost-based rates, and I feel it's a significant item to consider when it comes to designing rates, but there's a lot of other objectives that a lot of communities think about other than just cost of service. They want to achieve fairness to customers.
Is it not working?
I don't think it shows up on the screen.
It doesn't show up on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
One of them is fairness to customers. To me, fairness to customers is charging them what it costs to provide service. So, to me, cost-based rates achieves fairness to customers. Promoting economic development. A lot of communities want to promote economic development. And so they'll take a rate class. They may intentionally reduce it for a period of time to promote economic development. Some want to achieve certain community or social objectives, such as impacts on low income. What are the impacts on low income is oftentimes a big consideration. Environmental objectives, promote carbon-free resources and rooftop solar. These, for some communities, this is an important objective to them. All right, and promotion of electric vehicles is another one. And of course, from a utilities perspective, we want to maintain our financial stability. We want to make sure that we can continue to pay our bills, we can do the capital improvement programs that we need, so we can provide reliable electric service to our customers, which is the most important thing of everything else, providing reliable service. Also, stable rates for customers. We don't want to not increase rates for a period of time and set ourselves up for a large rate increase. We want our customers' rates Not that they're not going to change, but that the changes are relatively small. And they're done periodically because to lessen the impacts on the ratepayers themselves. All right, and it tends to keep for a more financially stable utility. But oftentimes an objective is to have stable rates. And like I said, by stable rates, I don't mean no increases. I mean no dramatic increases. And providing customers greater control over the bills with certain types of rate structures we implement or can implement can provide customers greater controls over the bills that they pay to the electric department. But I just wanted to go over these objectives because from this point on, I'm going to be talking about cost of service. All right. But again, I just want to emphasize that's one consideration when it comes to designing rates. So now I'm going to talk about the financials. You're a financially stable utility, and my main objective is to keep you that way. You know, and to look at that, we look at things like debt coverage ratio. For most utilities, they owe debt. Maybe you don't, at least at this point. Debt coverage is not an issue. We look at minimum cash levels. What is the minimum level of cash the utilities should maintain in reserves so that they can pay their bills in a timely fashion, do their capital improvement programs that's needed, and if a catastrophic event were to occur, then you have enough money in reserves to start the repair and replacement process. All right? Then you have what I term the upper boundary, or the ideal target, which is called the target operating income. And I'm going to give you a brief explanation of what I mean and what I'm trying to accomplish with that, is there's two ways of looking at your financials. One is on a cash basis, all right? Like the city's general fund operates on a cash basis. But the city's cost structure is a lot different than a utility's. A utility's cost structure is very heavily invested in assets. So we tend to look at our costs in a different light. It's called a utility basis or accrual accounting basis. And basically what we do is we say, we make an investment in an asset. It's not the cash outflow that we want to charge to our customers. It's the wear and tear on the infrastructure from that point forward. So if we make $1 million investment and that asset's going to last for 50 years, every year we want to charge our customers the wear and tear on that asset. And we quantify that in our accounting system through depreciation expense. All right. So what we do here is if we only charged depreciation expense to replace our assets, so that $1 million asset at the end of 50 years, we theoretically have recovered $1 million to replace the asset, right? But it's going to cost more than that to replace it. Because every year the replacement cost of that asset increases. So what this target operating income is or becomes is the inflationary increase in the asset's replacement cost. So if you look back over the last 20 years in the electric industry, the average inflation rate was about 3.2% on that, on our infrastructure. So that's what we're trying to recover, that inflationary increase in the replacement cost of infrastructure. So that becomes a target operating income. Now the reason we define that, we do a combination of looking at it from a cash basis, like what a city would do, but also we create an upper boundary or an optimal target, which is that target operating income. And when we set a rate track for a utility, we try to maintain between those two targets because we have to set rates high enough to maintain debt coverage ratio, if that was an issue, or to maintain minimum cash reserves. Our upper boundary becomes that target operating income. Now, by defining the boundaries, what that allows us to do is to develop a rate track that ultimately achieves relatively stable rates for our customers because we can phase rate adjustments in over time to achieve that optimal target operating income. as long as we have adequate cash reserves to do that. Does that make sense?
One question.
Yes.
On that annual inflation number, 3.2%, is that nationally, or do you ahead and do it regionally? There's no difference in your opinion.
It's nationally. It's actually 3.1% CPP. We do change that each year because we look at the Hand Equipment Index. And that's a national index. So.
Okay.
So, before I go on to talk about cash reserves, any questions? Now, cash reserves, as I mentioned earlier, we want to make sure you have cash in reserves to fund your working capital needs, which is the timing difference between when you pay bills for your customers and get your money from the customers, which is for any utility that bills monthly, that working capital leg is 45 days. So we want to make sure that's one. But we also want to make sure that we can fund your capital improvement program. If you have no debt, we want to make sure we can make your debt service payments. And also, what is your exposure to a catastrophic event? So how we quantify that is we look at your O&M cost, that 45-day working capital leg. In your case, it's actually a little bit less because we actually went through it. Estimate, I forget what it came out to, but it was like 30 days less than what we normally see. But we take 8.2% of your O&M expenses. Then we look at your historical investment in assets, which you have a relatively new system. In other words, the average infrastructure nationwide would make sense. It's about 50% depreciated. You're on the newer side of that. Let me just jump ahead. Your plant is only about 36% depreciated, and the average is 50. So you have newer infrastructure, which means that when we look at that, if you have newer infrastructure, when an ice storm or a windstorm comes by, you don't have as much exposure to something drastic happening to your assets. You have less exposure. But we want to at least recognize it. So what we do is we take 1% of your total historical investment infrastructure. And again, we're just recognizing it. That's all we're doing. It's really difficult to quantify it. So we just recognize that that risk exists. If you were an older system, over 55% depreciated, that number would be 3%. All right, we feel you need to maintain more cash because of the age of the infrastructure. So, and then we have your five-year capital improvement program, and we want to make sure that that's funded, that we have the money in reserves to start, to do the capital improvement program prior to actually starting the capital plan. And then we have your purchase power costs, and we look at the peak purchase power costs to occur throughout the year. We look at the working capital lag, because there's a timing difference between when, you know, Platte River will send you a bill the first part of the month, you may pay it by the end of the month to get that money a week later from your customers. So it's not as big of a working capital lag as is your traditional labor material type expenses. So that adds about $2 million a year. So your total cash reserves at a minimum, it's not a target, it's a minimum, it's about $12 million. All right. I have 11.7. Now, your projected cash reserves in 2020, with the proposed rate track we have, it's bringing us to about $12 million. So just slightly above the minimum. Now, as we move forward with the rate track that you'll see coming up, in 2024, our minimum cash reserves, about $12.7 million. Our cash balances are about $21 million. So, you know, again, that's a minimum. We're increasing it. Now, you had put together target or an ideal cash reserve policy, and it varies over this time frame, starting at 18% of O&M, moving up to 25%. It's what an internally approved policy. We're coming at it from a different direction, and we're kind of coming up with somewhat similar numbers. But in yours, in year one, it's almost identical to ours. And of course, in year two, once you start getting up to 25%, we're at 12.7%. you're at 18 million, but that's your desired balance. Ours is a minimum. Okay. So.
Before you go on, Mark, just a little background on this. When we did our last study with Mark, which was in 2016, we went through this drill, and the LUC and then ultimately council also supported increasing our minimum cash reserve level to be, it was at the time 15% of operating expenses, and we moved it up to 23% because that's what this calculation yielded. And then when we did our rate study last year with water and wastewater, there was a recommendation that we actually escalate to 33% of our operating expenses, and that was supported both by the LUC and by City Council in a minimum reserve policy that was taken by Teresa Wilson, the budget manager, back in February. So, and the way that that's written is that we would be gradually stepping up to the 33% of operating expenses by 2029. And I'm a little ahead here, but in our budget presentation, we actually get to the 33% before 2029 in all three of the utilities.
So is there any question? We're just kind of looking at the two targets. And again, remember, we're trying to define a range. We're not saying this is what you need to achieve. It's a range. Now, the target operating income, I kind of explained it. What we're trying to accomplish here is to recover the inflationary increase in an asset's replacement cost. So if you invest a $1 million asset with a 50-year life, that at the end of 50 years, you theoretically have that $1 million plus the inflationary increase in the replacement cost of the asset. So you have the cost in reserve, the money, in reserves to replace that asset. That's ideally what we're trying to accomplish. So what we did is, because you have contributed capital, contributed capital works differently. When a customer comes in and they, say, build a line and then donates it to the utility, they pay for that. So what we do when we calculate the number is we take the depreciation expense on assets that were contributed and we remove it. We don't charge the customer depreciation expense for assets they've contributed. We only charge depreciation expense for assets we paid for. Because if we charge them depreciation expense, we would be double charging them. So, but what I do is I do charge the inflation on that contributed asset. So if we have, because we have to ultimately replace it, so if the customer donated $1 million asset, we don't recover the $1 million. But every year the replacement cost of that asset, it goes up. We do charge them that inflation on the asset. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Pardon? So I calculated with the 3.1 of that, so about every 22 years, the cost of an asset doubles.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay.
It's a rule of 72.
Yeah, that's what I...
You got to be a finance person, the only finance person who could know that.
I got lost there. Let's say we get the $1 million contribution in the form of some asset. At some point, that has to be replaced.
Right.
Why is that not built into our future cost structure? I didn't.
The best way to look at it is this way, because we'd be double charging the customer. Is, let's say that you have two scenarios. One where the utility took $1 million out of their cash balance and paid for an asset. And another scenario where a customer paid for $1 million asset, so your cash outflow is zero at that point. All right, now, in the first scenario where you paid for it, you recover that $1 million over its useful life. So say 20 years. In 20 years, you recover the useful life. And when you take the $1 million cash outflow in year one, subtract out the what you recovered over the 20 years, $1 million, it nets to zero. But if the customer donated the asset, and your investment is zero, and you charge depreciation expense, you're going to recover $1 million. But now you're $1 million ahead because you had no cash outflow and you charged $1 million. So in the way it works in traditional rate making is on contributed assets, you don't charge the customer depreciation expense because it would result in that double charging scenario. You follow me? In one scenario,
I'll let Larry explain it to you.
You do that so accountants and that can make more money so you can understand.
So I'll take it. It must be true.
What was our average life of our depreciable assets then? About the whole blend.
I think for power, it's somewhere between 3, 5, and 40 years. So how is the eventual replacement of that asset? How is the reserve created? Where?
Just the only thing you're recovering on that is just the inflation. So there's no reserve for the $1 million.
So there's no reserve for the replacement of the asset.
Correct.
Whereas if we build it and we charge for it,
then you have a reserve.
Then you have a reserve for replacement.
Correct. But you don't in that situation because you haven't paid anything for it.
Yeah, got it.
So.
But I'm more worried about
it. I know.
Are you unique on this, or do most all utilities in the U.S. do this?
I can't comment on other consultants. The other ones I've seen try to back it up. Now, I do know, like, states that are regulated, they make you back out contributed assets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. Depreciation on it.
Okay.
Yeah. See, we're a little bit unique in how we look at the financials. I will say that for MISRA, because we have that target operating income. Most consultants will look more at your capital improvement plan in establishing your revenue requirements, where we establish a range rather than looking just purely at your capital. So we look at it a little bit different.
Yeah,
so
I'll get
that. Now,
maybe this will help. if you're not recovering that $1 million, so you can use that when it dies and you have to replace it. Essentially, you're going to put that into your capital improvements budget. Is that clear?
The key things to note here, I mean, for a system such as yours, your debt-to-equity ratio is zero. The average utility, similar in structure to Loveland's, which I call a distribution utility, their average debt-to-equity ratio is around 30, varies a little bit each year, but around 34%, which means that if you looked at the value of the system, they owe 34% of that is owed on debt. Right? You owe zero, so you're really financially stable. And the age of your plant is new, relatively new. Usually we see this in areas that have grown fast. I think, has Loveland grown pretty substantially over the years?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's typical that because you've grown a lot in recent years, you've made a lot of new investments in substations and lines, and so that's resulted in newer infrastructure. Eventually, it will need to be replaced, and that's what we're trying to do with the rate target operating income rate of return, is to build up those reserves so these assets and service here, you have the money to replace them. So when we pull it all together, and this is what I was looking for input on, with a rate track, remember there's really only two targets that are relevant here. One is your cash reserves and compared to the minimum, and two is the operating income compared to the targets, the upper boundaries, theoretically. So what we did is we put together a rate track, and a 5% increase the first year, 3%, 2, 2, and 2. All right, now, we're not looking to, I'll be honest with you, when we do a projection like this, especially out 5 years, I'm sure you've heard me say this before, when we look at the 2024 results, the only thing I'm certain of is that we're going to be wrong with this number, you know. And, you know, however, when we took out 2 or 3 years, we're pretty close. Because I had a lot more confidence in that. We look long-term assumptions change. And so, but with this rate track, your target operating income, that upper boundary, is $5.6 million. This puts us at 5.2, all right? So it gets us just slightly below it, again, slightly below the upper boundary. At the end of the year, 5 years, of course, a lot of things can change here. I'm going to stop here for right now, $6.2 million, which is about, you know, on track. At the end of 5 years, if this happened, if we looked at it again, we may want to go with a little bit stronger increase in 2024, but for financial planning purposes, I thought I'd just keep it at the 2%. But that's at 5.8 million. The target in that year is 7.5. So my first question is, we're looking to do a rate design of 5%. And do you agree with what we've done? You know, I want to emphasize, we're trying to deal with a range. It's somewhat subjective. You know, it's not an exact science when it comes to revenue requirement determination. And so this is why your input is so important to us, because what we'll do is we'll take that and go back and design rates to achieve that 5% increase.
Is this that 5 years close to what Platte River Power is projecting for?
It's the same thing, actually.
Mm-hmm. Platte River has a 1% increase proposed for 2020, and then it's 2% per year for the balance of the 5 years.
Okay. Yes. Would we be reviewing this on kind of an annual basis to kind of see if there's any adjustments that are required or necessary as we go forward?
Well, Jim reviews it each year, I believe, and we review it every 2 years. I believe it's every 2 years or 3 years.
Every 3 years,
but we
always have, so we'll have Mark's company design the rates for 2020, and then we'll have them also design the rates for 2021 so that we're stepping to cost of service.
You know, the other question I have is, do these costs include the addition of new utilities for new development, or would new development actually pay for those cost increases?
It was based on your capital plan and what your actual out-of-pockets were on it, which I think it did have a contributed asset part.
It does, yes.
Paid for by developers.
By developers,
yeah.
Okay. So this reflects still that those projected cash balances are where we went to started doing 2 years ago?
Yeah. This actually is getting us on the path to hitting that 33% of operating expenses as our minimum.
Okay. Now, one of the other questions that I think we're asking is which rate classes are going to be adjusted? Because you've got a percentage, but
it's coming up.
It's right here.
Okay.
Now, the average increase, to meet that target operating income that I had established, of course, 5% is not going to quite get us there, but the cost of services run using that number. So to hit that target operating income, we would need about 5.6% increase. We're not proposing that. But now, when you look at this, and I want to talk about a couple of different things we did differently this year. The 5.5% residentials came in at 4.2, slightly less than the average. So if we'd have 5%, they might get something slightly less. Small general service. Now I want to tell you a couple things we did different. Jim provided that class ranges from very, very small to up to 50 kW. They also have a lot of single phase service and a lot of three phase services. So what we did is we separated, I'm not showing it here because I summarized it, but we separated into three different groups. Small, very small, ones that we had demands up to 25 and ones that we had demand ratings up to 50. So by doing that, we were able to get more accurate because when you start getting around 25 kW, you're getting into three-phase services, where when you get into these small locations, it's only single phase. In the past, I've traditionally modeled this class as a three-phase service. Okay. So what I did here, I combined them. After I separated them, for presentation purposes, I combined those three segments of the class. Right.
So the self-gens are still embedded in residential?
Correct, they are. And the one class I said we've been working with is the wholesale. What that is, wholesale is the city. And, you know, it's basically what we do is we get them the average increase each year.
Is our mix kind of typical of cities our size, so residential is about less than 40% of the total revenue?
It's all over. I would say you're not. It's all over the place. Utility, I came from really 20% residential. I mean, but it's all over. It's hard to really. Actually, utility I worked for yesterday at their meeting out in Oregon, they were probably only 25% residential. You're 40%. It just varies so much. So,
and if I could say something else, Mark, as far as the study goes, part of what we scoped into this study is that, as Mark was mentioning, our small general service class is a pretty broad brush of customers. It goes from commercial customers with very small demand all the way up to 49 kW of demand. And so part of what we wanted to look at in the study was creating a medium commercial class, which would be from 26 to 49 kW. We ran into a plot complication when we looked into doing this because we actually don't have demand data on 60% of our small general service customers. The meters have the capability, but apparently the way that the meter readers have their readers programmed is that it's not downloading the demand data. So that is something that we eventually want to do, but we need data from those. It works. It's about 2,400 customers in order to really put together a sound database to work with, and then also to know which bucket each one of those customers would go into, whether it's 1 to 25 or 26 to 49. So that is something that we're going to be looking to do down the road. We have a new CIS system that's going to be coming online next year, and we're actually hoping to be able to get the demand information on those 2,400 customers starting even before the CIS comes online.
Who would be typically up around 49 kW then?
Who would be around 49? I was just thinking in a broad sense. Yeah. Some restaurants could be up in that range.
Okay. I do want to show you one thing that did change over here, especially in the primary. Quetzal Peak is difficult to model, but the primary and the large general service. Tyler Power Authority changed their price signal. And what they did is they took some of the demand-related costs out of demand and put it in what they call an owner's charge. All right, and I don't want to get too complicated. How that owner's charge is determined, it's based on 5 years worth of kilowatt hours that have been sold to you. All right, you have about a 20-21% interest in Platte River based on the kilowatt hour sales. Now, because they took it out of demand and placed it into energy, what happened is by reducing the demand, that harmed high load factor customers, such as these primary services and large general. The reason is because high load factor customers use more energy than they do demand. All right? So by the shifting it into the owner's charge, which is really a kilowatt hour based charge, it had more of an adverse impact on larger customers. So, and you know, when they were going the other way, we still gave them increases, you know, and gave them other classes less of an increase. I would recommend going up 11%, but the key question is if you're okay with the 5%, what kind of bandwidth amount will you allow me? 2%, 1%? If you allow me,
yeah, plus
2%,
or minus.
Plus or minus, yeah. Which means that like primary service might go up 6.5, 6 or 7%. All right. Or residential's, it'd probably be about 4.5 or something. But you know, that band range, that range that you provide us, that bandwidth, determines the ultimate increase for each of these classes. So
that is one of the items that we're looking for direction from you on today is, if we did the overall average 5% plus or minus 2, then no rate class would get higher than a 7% increase, and no rate class would get less than a 3% increase.
So two questions, still the sum's got to equal $72 million.
Correct.
And then there will still be a goal if you only give, we talked about this before, you're talking about 2% per year or 2% in 1 year with primary service if clients don't pay. That's not going to close the gap to that they're paying their fair share and somebody's subsidizing them, right?
A little bit, but eventually we'll get there because every year we make a little change.
That's every year then?
Well,
we would, and that's what I was referring to earlier, Larry, was that we'll go back to Mark again next year to make that second step toward cost of service. So then in this case, the primary service and the coincident peak customers would get a higher than average rate increase next year as well.
Because you understood this better than I did. When looking through, 3 years ago, the small general service was underpaying.
Yeah. Right, it was like 12% correction you needed there.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, well, we closed it partly because of the adjustment, but the other part was by separating the rate, we were able to get a more accurate picture of the small general service because we separated it into three classes or three segments, and then we were able to actually, knowing that some are single phase, some are you know, three phase, having to get a better picture on what's called load factors because we didn't have good load data before. So by separating out, we just got a better picture of the class. So you're going to see some of the changes in the next slide because of that.
Just real quick, how many, well, first off, you've got, I don't know, what, 8 customer classes there. Are there then subclasses within those? Like residential, are there different classes within residential?
Correct.
Classes
you're going to have like solar, I believe, is going to be like within the residential.
So how many customers fall in each of those classes?
I can't, well, residential was like 30.
Residential is about 34,000.
Yeah. As far as the subclasses, like solar is pretty small.
Yeah, that's small, but small general service, how many are we talking about?
2,400, 3,000.
That's how many we don't have data on.
Yeah. But the range is from, like I said, 0 to 50. So there's no really subcategories. Although we may want to create subcategories. And I was going to talk about that in the next slide.
I would say, Councilor, just as a on small general service ballparking, I'm going to say about 3,600. Wholesale is around 100. Those are the city accounts. That's about 100. Area lighting, you're not sure on that one.
Well, rather than get off the cuff, can you bring that to council and come?
Certainly can.
Okay. Rather than delay it here. Would you prefer I ask my questions at council? Or?
Oh, no, absolutely not. You can ask them here, you can call me on the phone, send me an email.
Okay. I don't want to mess up the presentation.
No. Absolutely not. So, again, the next question I'll come back with is what kind of bandwidth around that 5%? Would you allow me plus or minus 2%, which means no class would see greater than 7%, but everybody would see at least a
3%. That's what we did 3 years ago.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we do that to try to prevent, you try to move too quickly. One risk is from a customer's perspective, the bills could skyrocket, but there's another risk. Costs change over time. So if we try to change the cost of service 1 year, and then all of a sudden Platte River changes the rate structure like they did, now all of a sudden we're trying to reverse course. And so it's best just to move slowly, and you know, knowing that it's going to go up and down a little bit each time. Does that make sense? Now I'm going to get into the customer charge, and I know you've heard me this before, but a lot of times that customer charge is misunderstood. I mean, people don't really understand what it is or why it's there. And I mean, in a nutshell, if a customer has a meter installed on their home, the electric utility had the cost to install the meter. They also had the responsibility to repair it, to replace it. The meter, to read the meter every month, to send a bill to that meter, and the cost of a service job going out to the road. Those are all fixed costs that do not vary based on consumption. Those are investments the utility made on behalf of that specific customer. All right? And that represents this first part that I have up here. Then I have this section in red. This is where there's some controversy in the industry. We still need to have a wire that goes from the substation to the customer's home. Then the question becomes, how much of that wire should be put into the customer charge component, and how much should be put within the energy or demand component of the rate? Okay. So what we do, there's the industry standard, what we use, is called a minimum.